Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
By all accounts, the results of the 2010 midterm elections in the United States were astounding, to say the least. Not since the 1938 elections has there been such a dramatic switch between parties in the U.S. House of Representatives, with at least 60 seats switching from the Republicans to the Democrats as of November 9th, the date we are recording this podcast. And a few races are still too close to call or facing possible recounts. The Republicans also picked up 6 seats in the U.S. Senate. More surprisingly, and perhaps less reported in the national news media, was the fact that Republicans gained over 675 seats in state legislatures, to only a handful of gains for Democrats. In the upcoming year, when the states will undergo the process of redistricting their electoral maps, the state legislative results may impact the shape of Congress in the near future. Beyond the election of politicians, outcomes for a number of ballot initiatives demonstrated a general mood among the populace for lower taxes, less government spending, and more conservative public policy. In a previous podcast with Corwin Smith, we discussed how religious voters have trended conservative in recent decades, with the greatest predictor of political attitudes being how often one attended church, more so than one's religious affiliation. At the time we recorded that podcast, in September of 2010, we did not have the benefit of knowing exactly what the midterm elections would bring, nor what effect religious voters would have on the outcome. Now, with the elections over, we do have some better idea of what happened. Scholars will undoubtedly pore over election returns and public opinion polls in the coming months to figure out what exactly went on. But that kind of data analysis takes time, and the results are not likely to be published for several months or even a year after the election. And like a 70-year-old with unbridled enthusiasm on the night before Christmas, I just can't wait to tear open the wrapping and open the box that those elections represent. So, to best accomplish that mischievous goal, I thought it'd be a good idea to get the insights of a news correspondent who has his ears to the ground in Washington, D.C. And since we're a program that focuses on the study of religion, it only made sense to get a reporter from a religiously based media outlet, as he would likely be more in tune with what is happening on the religious scene. To that effect, I'm glad to be joined today by David Brody, the senior White House correspondent for the Christian Broadcasting Network, or CBN. David is an Emmy Award-winning journalist who has interviewed the top names on the political landscape, including Barack Obama, John McCain, Hillary Clinton, and Harry Reid, to name just a few. He also appears regularly on other news networks, including MSNBC, NPR, and Fox News. And his political blog, The Brody File, has been featured in America's top newspapers, such as the New York Times and the Washington Post. And I had the opportunity to actually look at some of his video podcasts, and they're really funny. Who knew that Christians could be funny? So David, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks so much for having me, Tony. Yes, Christian's funny. What are you talking about?
I know. We have a upcoming podcast on the Christian right and what they represent in the general public and their democratic virtues. And we cover a number of different stereotypes about Christians. And one of those stereotypes is that they tend to lack a sense of humor. So, but that's not always the case. And I urge people to go to your website, and we'll put a link on our website and check it out, because they're really not only informative, but very amusing.
I appreciate it.
Okay, so today is November 9th. We're a week out from the elections here. And what is the mood of Washington, D.C. at the moment?
Well, I think it depends where you reside. If you reside at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, to use a biblical analogy, it may be somewhat like Armageddon to a degree. I mean, look, they're hurting, and they understand that not only were the midterm elections not the outcome that they wanted, but that there was clearly some sort of mandate here that the American people, and message that the American people were sending, even though there might be an asterisk with that. But in terms of what's the mood in Washington, I think people are gritting for gridlock. I mean, I think that's what it is. I think that you know, there's a clear path here forward for Republicans and for Democrats, in the sense that there's going to have to be decisions made on both sides. And so the real question for this Obama administration is, can they pivot? And this is something the president's going to have to figure out. Is he going to pull a Bill Clinton in 1994, or is he going to go, in essence, take the bury the head in the sand approach? And with that comes quite a bit of peril, not to mention the fact that it could end up making him a one-term president if he's not careful.
Yeah, that's, you know, what the general read has been here, and we're still only a week out from the elections, and President Obama is overseas right now, so everything is still sorting its way out. In terms of the electorate, what do you think the message they were sending? Were they sending, we want gridlock, we want to stop the direction the country is going for at least now, or do you think there's a willingness amongst the population to see some more compromise on the part of politicians and move things in a different direction?
Well, they definitely want to see compromise. You know, I've been all across this country, not just at Tea Party rallies, but at different events that kind of ran the gamut from Democrat to Republican events. And the bottom line is that they want to see progress, but they are saying, in essence, enough with all of these big government policies. In other words, you know, the President of the United States talked about the stimulus being an emergency. He talked about the bailouts being an emergency. Everything became an emergency. Health care, if you remember, became an emergency. If we didn't do something about health care, you know, he talked about the economic impact of that. And folks around the country, in essence, weren't buying it. And so I think the mood of the country right now is to say, well, wait a minute. Hold on for a second. I was sitting on the couch watching Oprah, and I really didn't want to do anything else, and you really bothered me here, federal government, Obama administration, because you got me off the couch, and that's what the Tea Party movement's been about. These are folks that had no desire to get involved in the political process, but the federal government, starting with the Bush administration, continuing on with the Obama administration, it was too much, and too much encroachment by the federal government. And so there is an exasperation, a frustration within the American electorate today, and that message was clearly sent on November 2nd.
Now, there's been a number of autopsies done on the election results, and you know, for many media personnel, autopsy might be the correct word here. Most of those have focused really on bread and butter issues, such as the general state of the economy, unemployment figures, growth of government, as you just mentioned, and the passage of the recent health insurance legislation. For the most part, what I have been hearing is that the line is this was a secular election dominated by secular issues. To what extent, as a broadcaster for the Christian Broadcasting Network, do you think that's correct? Did we see this as a secular election as compared to 2004, when a lot of people were talking about values voters?
Well, I think what's happening, Tony, is a lot of people want to put issues and people in a box. And you mentioned a secular election. And I think what we're seeing here is that the economic issues, the secular issues, if you will, not abortion and marriage and all of the big hot-button social issues, what we're seeing now with these financial economic issues, they are becoming moral issues. And so when we talk about a secular election as opposed to maybe an election that where faith and social issues had more of a role, it's actually starting to intersect far more deeply in a far greater way than we've ever seen before. I know we're going to get into some of this a little later about the Tea Party and evangelicals, so I'll leave that off the table for now. But let me just simply say that the way this is now being defined within the evangelical community is that a rising national debt is a moral issue. Mm-hmm. Spending, out of control spending, is a moral issue as it relates to the future generations and future family members. So this is the way evangelicals are now seeing this, and that's why they've kind of joined together with the Tea Party movement, and we'll talk about that more later. But in answer to your question, though abortion and same-sex marriage didn't grab the headlines, and all of the typical 1980 through 2000 issues didn't grab the headlines, the economic issues are now moral issues. But look, let me just point out one other thing. Let's remember that if you were a pro-life Democrat who voted for President Obama's health care bill, you know, Tuesday was not a good day for you. You know, as a matter of fact, I think I wrote on my blog something along the lines of that we would be providing free Excedrin to those members. Because, look, I mean, out of all of those pro-life Democrats, there were about 20 of them that voted for President Obama's health care bill. 15 of them were defeated. What was the number one issue at the end of that health care bill? It was abortion. It could have gone down based on Bart Stupak and the whole abortion issue. So look, even on issues where we're talking about economic issues, even when we're talking about health care and we're talking about big government regulation, what ended up getting in the way? What ended up being a big issue? Abortion. Abortion always comes up, rears its ugly head, if you will. So that issue is not going away anytime soon. And I think we even saw, like I said, that pro-life element play significantly in 2010.
Yeah, I remember reading that on your blog, and I thought that was an excellent point that you had made, how the moral issue of abortion really intersected with this health care legislation. It's very difficult to parse those two out. And as you mentioned, Bart Stupak was leading a caucus of pro-life Democrats to, at the last minute, get certain restrictions on abortion inserted into the health care bill. That seemed as if the bill was going that way, and so his caucus turned in that direction. As you mentioned, a number of these people went down. Bart Stupak himself did not actually run for re-election.
And
I was wondering, I didn't check this, and I probably should have, but do you know if a Republican or a Democrat took Stupak's seat? He's in Northern Michigan, if I'm correct.
A Republican took the seat.
Okay.
I'll double-check on the name, but there was the Republican won that seat, and there were quite a few of those pro-life Democrats that lost out to Republicans. So, once again, a switch in those seats.
And that might have been a surprise coming to them. They probably thought they neutralized a religious vote or this moral issue when they took that stand, but certainly didn't seem that way in these elections here.
That's right.
Let me ask you, you had the opportunity to report on the 2008 presidential race for CBN, and that seemed to be a watershed or a landmark election. It was one of these elections that, in compared to the past 20 or 30 years, there seemed to be a clear mandate going in one direction. You'd think back to, you know, the contested election of 2000, and even when Clinton won his elections with less than 50% of the majority. You actually have President Obama coming in with a fairly sizable majority, and the Democrats picking up some substantial gains in the House of Representatives and the Senate. What differences have you noticed between that 08 election and 2010 here? It's only been two short years, but has there been a sea change in different directions? What kind of vibe do you pick up from these the electoral seasons here?
Well, there's so much to talk about on that question. It's a great question, Tony. I think what happened here, if you look at the demos, if you look at the demographics, I mean, he lost independents, he being the president, this White House, the Democratic Party. They lost independents, they lost women, they lost the young voters, if you will, in the sense that they didn't turn out as much as they did in 2008. Now, of course, you got a presidential election compared to a midterm election. But having said all of that, the big issue here with this president has been the fact that he campaigned, if you will, as a moderate. And let me put an asterisk next to that. I mean, a lot of what he was saying was still a big government liberal philosophy, you know, spread the wealth, talk to Joe the plumber, you know, hey, look, we need to help people, you know, and spread that money around. So, I mean, it was big government liberalism, but it was cloaked in quite a bit of moderate language. And then when he came to Washington, and this is what the Beltway will do to you, and believe me, if you drink the Potomac water frequently, you will get sick. And I think that's exactly what happened to President Obama and his administration. It's one thing to campaign. It's another thing to govern. And what he found out is that Republicans were going to make life difficult for him. So instead of going and tracking to the middle and trying to meet somewhere in the middle, he decided to say, look, I know that they're going to defeat me, or they're going to try to defeat me. So you know what? I've got a two-year window, and I'm going to do everything I possibly can to get things done in that two-year window. I remember having an off-the-record conversation, so I'll just keep it somewhat generic, but an off-the-record conversation with a top Obama administration official who said, look, we're coming to Washington to do big things, basically, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And so the stimulus, the bailouts, health care, financial regulatory reform, they had a two-year window. They were going to go ahead and take it, no matter what the cost, what the political cost, and live with the results, or, in this case, suffer the consequences. So I think what we saw here in the last 2 years was, in essence, a turning a blind eye, if you will, to the folks in this country. Take a look at health care, for example. The polls on health care, why did President Obama always say that he knew this was a tough vote for many House Republicans or House Democrats? Because the polling wasn't all that great. It was not good. They went ahead and basically saw that the polling was not good, saw that the electorate wasn't buying the messaging coming from healthcare, that the president wasn't selling it, but did it anyhow. And when you try to do huge social legislation like this in a partisan, not a bipartisan, but a partisan way, you're going to suffer the consequences. So I think you had a moderate sounding president in 2008 and more of a liberal governing philosophy the last 2 years, and that has come back to bite him.
Yeah, that again is focusing on a lot of the bread and butter issues. What about the role of religion in these two different elections? Was religion a bigger factor in 2008 than 2010, or was it about the same? Did it play less of a role than in previous elections? What's your take on that as an insider journalist here?
Two things happened, Tony. First of all, the evangelical movement became more aggressive between 2008 and 2010. Everyone from a Ralph Reed and the Faith and Family Coalition, Faith and Freedom Coalition, and to some other conservative evangelical groups who decided to mobilize against President Obama on the fiscal issues, on health care, on the fact that the deficit is growing, on all of the big government liberalism. So what they did is they started creating everything from huge email lists to huge phone banks to accumulating all this information on evangelicals to get them to the polls to vote. There was a decided and a cumulative effort on many evangelical groups' parts. That wasn't taking place as much in 2008 because of John McCain, the candidate. But between 2008 and 2010, they were able to run against Obama, and they were able to deliver evangelical votes. The other part of this is that the Democratic National Committee did not put as much effort into courting evangelical votes, moderate and progressives that we've heard so much about. They're not going to grab so many of these conservative evangelicals, but they sure had a tapping into in 2008 of the moderate and progressive evangelicals. They didn't do that in 2010. They didn't put a emphasis on that. And same thing with the Obama administration. The Obama administration, from President Obama, whether he had the issues with, you know, where was he going to attend church in D.C., to some of the outreach with the faith community, it was pretty static. There wasn't much movement at all. He courted a lot of these leaders in 2008 during the campaign, but once he got elected, that pretty much stayed steady. There was really no energy in that faith coalition that he built in 2008. So you take all three of those factors, and what did you end up finding out? Well, what happened was in 2010, this was the biggest turnout of evangelical voters in midterm election, postmodern midterm election history. Yeah. And you put all that together, and that's what you get.
That's absolutely fascinating. You just see that I guess, teeter-totter, seesaw swing there in the electoral vote, and also who is courting who in that. Let me take you back to 2008, and why weren't evangelicals as active back then? What's your thinking on that?
Well, first of all, as it relates to 2008, it would be John McCain was a real big problem for evangelicals. You know, at the end of the day, you need enthusiasm, mm-hmm. and John McCain didn't provide that at all. And honestly, Tony, I mean, we can talk about other issues, but the truth of the matter is that if evangelicals had a candidate that they were enthused about, for example, if Sarah Palin was going to be president of the United States or running against Obama, it may have been different it would have been different in terms of evangelical turnout. So the number one factor was John McCain. And that's why in 2012, as we move closer, you know, where will evangelicals come down, and what side will they come down on? I mean, you know, John McCain just didn't do it for him in 2008.
Yeah, I remember talking with Corwin Smith on an earlier podcast, and I had been interviewed on a radio show about religion in the 2008 elections, and somebody asked me, well, what denomination does John McCain belong to? And I couldn't give you an answer on that. I had to go back and look it up, and I still think I'm pretty fuzzy on it, if it was a Baptist denomination or not, but McCain didn't really wear that religious affiliation on his sleeve as candidates in the past had on the Republican side.
No, he really didn't. You know, technically, what would his affiliation be? He'd call himself a Baptist, I think, if someone, you know, asked him about it, but that's just because he attends a Baptist church in the Arizona area. But look, I mean, I had serious discussions with his two top religious liaisons, if you will, about getting Senator McCain to sit down and talk with me about many of these issues as it relates to his faith. And I talked to him twice, but he didn't really want to go there. I mean, the two times I talked to him and I asked him these questions, you know, some candidates want to go there, others don't. And John McCain really never really wanted to go there. He would talk about the one story about how there was a line in the sand when he met the POW over in Vietnam. And we've heard this story ad nauseum about how that, you know, he drew a cross in the sand, and that said a lot to John McCain at the time. Well, that's wonderful, but, you know, we really never got the personal side of John McCain, because that's just not who John McCain is. And look, the truth of the matter is, why did President Obama get elected? Why did Bill Clinton get elected? Why did George W. Bush get elected? Because they were able to relate to people on a personal level. Right. Bill Clinton, I feel your pain. You know, this whole idea that you're able to relate to folks. And John McCain wasn't able to do it, not only with the general electorate, but definitely evangelicals.
In terms of some of the more specific religious issues, going back to the 2008 campaign and how it might relate to the 2010, I know that we just talked about John McCain's religious affiliation, but the whole issue of Reverend Wright came up in the 2008 election for President Obama, and that seemed to dog him for a while early in the general election. Actually, it dates back to the primaries. But that seemed to be brushed aside. Coming up to the 2010 election, in terms of issues that had a more specific religious overtone like that, the only one I could really put my finger on would have been the issue of the New York City mosque at Ground Zero, as well as the Quran burning that came up shortly thereafter. What's your take on very specific hot-button issues like this? How was President Obama able to brush aside the Reverend Wright issue? Has it come back to haunt him because he hasn't been seen going to church very much? And what do you make of this New York City mosque controversy?
Well, my goodness, that you bring up such a great point and an actual three specific elements, you know, the mosque and the Quran burning and the mosque in New York City, Quran burning and Reverend Wright, because all three of them go to a narrative about this president, especially as it relates to the mosque in New York City and Reverend Wright, which is that poll number that we've always seen. 25% of Americans think the president is a Muslim.
Right.
And it's fascinating, Tony. I mean, this is a guy that I've sat down with four times, Barack Obama, who has pleaded with people to say, look, I'm a Christian. You know, I believe in Jesus Christ. I believe he died for my sins. We've got him on tape. I've listened to him many, many times. But he cannot seem to escape this. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Everything from, you know, where he grew up as a child to his name and the whole thing. And people buy into this. But here's the point. In 2008, the Reverend Wright story was the turning point in President Obama's ascension to victory, if you will. And the reason it was the turning point is because he got out of it. He got in front of it early. He was able to turn it, pivot, talk about race relations, make it a higher issue than just the Reverend Wright. And then he actually distanced himself from Reverend Wright eventually, once Reverend Wright went, commando, if you will, at the National Press Club back then. So he was able to get in front of the issue, turn it, make it bigger, and it ended up not hurting him to the point where he was able to get elected. Now, and here comes the mosque issue. Once again, he got dinged up on that pretty good regarding the mosque issue in New York, but that is playing into this perception that he's a Muslim. And it's fascinating to me to watch because, you know, that figure, Tony, started at 10%, then went to 12%. Now it's up to 25%. What's next? This week, he'll be attending a mosque and services there in Indonesia. I mean, you wonder if anybody is home at the White House going, you know, is this the best visual we want to send to 25% of Americans who think he's a Muslim, and here he goes into a mosque and doing what he needs to do. So, look, I mean, I think it's a real tangible problem for this administration as to the perception problem, and it goes to even a larger issue, which is that the president, I'm getting off a little bit on the subject, but just real quick, the president had so many perception problems going in. He was looked upon as a big government liberal by a lot of his critics, and then he actually did the stimulus and the bailouts and health care, and he proved them right. And so, you know, when you have a messaging issue and you have a perception problem, it all is all going to come back to haunt you at some point, and it sure did in 2010, and he's got to be careful about 2012.
In terms of how that really affected the electorate, do you think that played in, or perhaps at the margins with some individuals it did, but what's your thought on that?
In terms of the mosque in New York City?
And the whole perception of Obama as a Muslim, The percentage of people who are thinking that way increasing over the time. That was a big issue in August of 2010. And then it seemed after Labor Day to fade away. And so my question was, well, I was thinking back in August, this is going to be a big issue, and I wonder how this is going to affect the midterm elections, because, yeah, it is. He's not up for election, but it is a mandate on his policies and the trust we have in the Democrats. But after Labor Day, it seemed to fade away, and I completely forgot about that poll, and I'm wondering if the rest of the electorate did or if it had some kind of impact on people.
Well, I think it did have an impact, and it's empirically, it may be hard to prove, but I think when you take that and when you take all sorts of issues as it relates to the president, it all becomes a factor, because ultimately, why do we vote for politicians, or why do we vote against politicians? We usually vote with our heart. We either like them or we don't.
Mm-hmm.
We don't typically vote about policies. I mean, some do, and we definitely vote philosophy, but we're talking about the general voter here. I mean, we don't have a situation in our country, unfortunately, where people pay too much attention to policy. I mean, look at healthcare, for example. There are a lot of people that thought that all of these death panels were going to be instituted as part of the healthcare reform bill. Well, it wasn't really death panels. I mean, Sarah Palin was making the argument about how they could turn into death panels. But if you look at the exit polling from the election, that many voters across the country bought into the fact that they didn't like healthcare because of the death panels that were coming. So, I mean, certain issues stick with people no matter how long. I mean, the death panels was 6 months ago at least, or longer, 9 months ago. And so you put that with the 25% think he's a Muslim. I think it all plays into a perception about this president. And he even admitted, Tony, that he got defined by the Republicans. And they did a good job of that, and it cost him in 2010.
One of the things you mentioned earlier about the 2010 elections was a lot of people got up off the couch, and one could see how these different issues, from death panels to the perception of Muslims to the New York City mosque controversy, prompts people just to get up off the couch into a mode of political activism, and then other issues might jump onto their bandwagon or to their plate, so to speak. And that brings up the issue of the Tea Party movement that seemed to be one of the big themes here in the 2010 election, that an uprising of citizen activists that we haven't seen specifically from the right in a long time, or from the right, and I should also say from a libertarian perspective. The Tea Party movement, as it's portrayed in the media, has largely been, again, a bread and butter economic type of issue: smaller government, lower taxes, stop the spending. But was there a religious presence among the Tea Party? You mentioned that evangelicals were getting more mobilized in this election than they had in the past several elections. How connected were the evangelicals with the Tea Party movement? Was there a religious dimension or undertone to the Tea Party movement, or were these two separate things going on?
Not only, Tony, was there an undertone, but there was major fusion between the two. As a matter of fact, I decided to coin a new phrase and call the folks that are evangelicals that are part of the Tea Party movement, like to call them T-evangelicals.
Ooh, that's a good name.
A little catchy, I guess.
Yeah, well, we'll give you credit for that
That's right. I'm running down to the patent and trademark office as we speak, Tony. But look, I mean, here's the truth of the matter, and this is the most misreported story of the whole 2010 and midterm elections, that the Tea Party crowd is a fiscally conservative bunch, and social conservatives and evangelicals have nothing to pretty much do with the movement at all. Absolutely incorrect. Not only incorrect, but intellectually lazy, quite frankly, by the media. Look, I've been to so many of these Tea Party rallies, I can't even begin to think straight here. They open up in prayer, all of them. Many of them saying, you know, they'll end it by saying in Jesus' name.
Well, that you never see on the media.
No, you'll never see that. But that is how they all start. It starts with a prayer, in Jesus' name, amen. Then it starts with then the Pledge of Allegiance, then America the Beautiful song. It's all of that. And then they start to have folks come up on stage that talk about, yes, fiscal issues, but then they start to talk about how the reason that we even exist as a nation is because of God. They talk about God and the founding fathers and the underpinnings of the society. And so God is invoked at least 10 to 15 times during an hour rally, hour and 15-minute rally. This is, in essence, Tony, the new religious right movement in America. It is part, I'm not suggesting that the Tea Party crowd, the libertarian crowd, is buying into the religious right message. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm saying is that the religious right has found a home in the Tea Party, that the economic issues that the Tea Party is talking about resonate with evangelicals because they have been defined as moral issues. And let's also remember, Tony, that if the Tea Party is successful, evangelicals will be successful. Why is that? Because if the Tea Party is successful with their candidates, and all of a sudden the Republicans gain back the House, which they have, and possibly gain back the Senate, which they may very well do in 2012, there is going to be a Republican agenda on Capitol Hill, not to mention if they gain back the presidency. And with a Republican agenda comes typically a pro-family values agenda, social issues as well. And that could be reversing the Mexico City policy, for example, as it relates to abortion. So, you know, all of these things play a role. But the Tea Party is an evangelical, or the Tea Party members and evangelicals are definitely together for the most part. As a matter of fact, you know, there was that survey out, you may have seen it, but nearly half, 47%, say they are not only just part of the Tea Party movement, but they're part of the religious right or conservative Christian movement. And so, you know, there's huge crossover.
A lot of this manifested itself to me in Glenn Beck's Rally to Restore Honor, yeah. The rally that was held a couple weeks before the election. And when I hadn't been paying much attention to it, and so when I heard that Glenn Beck was going to have a big rally, I said, oh, it's another Tea Party rally. But watching the news coverage of it and looking into it a little bit deeper, I found that it really was about the heritage of America, and it was the heritage of America with that religious undertone to it. So in many ways, I was surprised by that, but I guess we can see through that rally that this connection between evangelicals, between the religious right and the Tea Party movement was occurring there. We should have actually been seeing that more clearly prior to that.
Well, that's right. And, you know, he talks about, Glenn Beck talked about turning back to God.
Mm-hmm.
And that is basically what I was saying a little bit earlier as it relates to the fact that, you know, these Tea Party rallies open up in prayer and God invokes so much. So Glenn Beck, I mean, he in essence was showing the all of America that God is at the center of all of this. And then, of course, he moves on to other issues as it relates to, well, if God is at the center of it, you know, God is imploring all of us to do our part to get off the couch and go do something about
right.
it. But, you know, there are a lot of other issues as it relates to Glenn Beck as to how evangelicals feel about that. You know, I wrote quite a few things on my blog about it, and there's a schism. There's a big difference how evangelicals feel about Glenn Beck's role in all of this when he invokes God, because obviously he's a Mormon. So that's a whole other ball of wax as to whether or not he should be doing that.
Well, in terms of we're talking about the schisms now within this Tea Party movement. We talked about how there's a strong evangelical influence it, and how they open a lot of the meetings by invoking Jesus during prayer. Do you see attention growing within this movement now that there's been some degree of victory, that the more libertarian elements of the movement are going to start clashing with the more religious elements of the movement? What are your thoughts on that?
No, I don't see that, Tony, and here's why. Because, for lack of a better term, evangelicals know their place in this movement, in the sense that there has been no desire/effort to co-opt this movement. It wouldn't work, first of all. But beyond that, the evangelicals realized that this is much broader than abortion and gay marriage. That's not, look, they can fight those battles at the state level. They can fight those battles through regulation when they get a new president in 2012 if they have their way. But what this is about for evangelicals is people, as Glenn Beck says, turning back to God, to realizing where their bread is buttered, if you will, that God is number one and should be number one and needs to be the focus of all of this in terms of why America is so great and why God is even greater. And so as long as God is getting the credit, God is getting the glory, evangelicals are okay with that. They don't need to have their issues of abortion and same-sex marriage and all that other stuff be part of the Tea Party policy equation. They'll have their fights and battles on Capitol Hill, but they won't necessarily have it within the Tea Party.
Do you think the Glenn Beck rally and how these schisms are starting to arise not only between secular libertarians and the evangelicals, but you mentioned Glenn Beck as a Mormon, and one of the top names mentioned for a 2012 presidential run is Mitt Romney. Do you think that is going to be a tension that is going to manifest itself in the next coming years, or has there been, as you say, between secular libertarians and evangelicals, there's a agreement to disagree on some issues, but we're all in this together? Is it the same thing with the Mormon evangelical divide?
Well, I think there's definitely a Mormon evangelical divide, and I think it's far worse than the Tea Party or the libertarian evangelical divide. In other words, I think libertarians, you know, live in their world, evangelicals live in their world, and they can come together on a Saturday at a rally. I don't think that's an issue. I think there is very much so an issue between what Mormons believe and what evangelicals believe, and as it relates to policy and public figures, I think it's been problematic for people like Mitt Romney, who felt that in 2008, and guess what, Tony, he's going to feel it again in 2012.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the Mormon issue is never going to go away. I don't think it'll be as intense in 2012 as it was in 2008, but then, oh my goodness, look what's coming around the corner for Romney, healthcare in Massachusetts.
Right.
That's going to be a problem. So, you know, Romney may be maybe one of the unluckiest guys out there. You know, he thinks he might have been able to get past the Mormon issue because, okay, well, that's off the table since it was discussed in 2008, but now he's got a whole new issue to deal with. So.
Yeah. In talking about specific candidates, and we're talking about presidential candidates here, but let's get back to the 2010 midterm elections. It's a congressional race going on here. You had the opportunity to interview a couple of key players in the recent elections, including Christine O'Donnell, who was the Republican Senate candidate from Delaware trying to win Joe Biden's seat. Her most famous connection to the supernatural happened to be a statement that she made some 10 or more years ago on a comedy program, Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect program, where she talked about dabbling in witchcraft. And this was when she was a teenager, early 20s or so. However, you did an interview with her, and during that interview, she also came out with a statement that she felt moved by God to run in this election. So what was your take on Christine O'Donnell's Senate run, which really garnered a lot of attention in the last few weeks of the lead up to the campaign or to the election here?
Yeah, well, where do I begin on her? Let me start with more kind of an overall view of Christine O'Donnell and candidates like her and Sharon Engel. I think the lesson of the Tea Party in 2010 wasn't that the message didn't resonate. I mean, clearly the message resonated. We saw that. I mean, that was obvious. The lesson going forward for the Tea Party movement is how do they take their message and make it mainstream enough to attract independents? I'm going to get to Christine O'Donnell here in a moment, but Marco Rubio and Rand Paul were able to win in Kentucky and Florida, and they were able to win independents because they were able to explain the Tea Party message in a common-sense conservative way, and it attracted independents. Christine O'Donnell, Sharon Engel, weren't able to do that as well. There was a lot of bumps in the road for both of them. You mentioned the dabbled in witchcraft thing with O'Donnell or the event there, and then there were a few other things too. For example, for example, the separation of church and state issue. Okay, she was technically right on that. There is no mention of separation of church and state in the Constitution, but she wasn't able to articulate what her main point of saying that was. In other words, her main point was, this is how the media likes to, and Chris Coons and others like to run behind this wall of separation of church and state to go ahead and try to take God out of the public square. But she was never able to articulate that. So the point here, Tony, is that what the Tea Party needs to do is get the right messengers, not necessarily change the message. And that starts way before the primary season. As it relates to Christine O'Donnell, I mean, I had a conversation with her for about 20, 25 minutes on camera, and she just started opening up about God. I mean, she, you know, that this was her calling. And she talked about so many things as it relates to how she got into the race and why she felt that God was calling her to do so. And it's really fascinating to talk to these candidates about these issues because, let's face it, the last time I checked, Wolf Blitzer is not going to ask her about God.
Right.
Matt Lauer on the Today Show is not going to ask her about God, and just go down the list. And so David Gregory, Meet the Press. So, look, I mean, this is an opportunity at CBN, at the Christian Broadcasting Network, to ask her, Sharon Angle, Tim Scott down in South Carolina, the candidate down there. These type of candidates who I've talked to on the road, they want to talk about their faith. It's their worldview. It's who they are. So this is it's interesting because the media made a big deal of my interview with O'Donnell at the time because she talked about God's influence in her life in this campaign and that how prayer works and talked about how prayer was directly responsible for the uptick in her poll numbers and stuff like that. So the media, you know, kind of laughs and stickers in a corner, but for evangelicals, conservative evangelicals across this country, they look at that and go, well, what's the problem? Yeah, prayer works, newsflash.
Right, right.
Or that this is my worldview. So Christine O'Donnell didn't necessarily have a problem with so much of her views about God. It was more about a lot of that Bill Maher stuff back in the 90s.
Yeah, I want to come back a little bit later to talk specifically about your role as a journalist on a Christian news network, mm-hmm. because as you mentioned, this was the opportunity for Tim Scott, Christine O'Donnell, and others to get that message out to a constituency, or what just might be in their heart, where they cannot get it out on a regular news network or a secular news network, or without perhaps being made fun of. But before we do that, let's pull back and still finish up here with the elections.
Yeah.
In terms of, we've talked a bit about the candidates here. Were there other issues across the United States in state referendum or ballot initiatives that had a religious tone to them that resonated with evangelicals? What did the non-candidate initiatives look like out there?
Well, obviously, the one in Iowa with the judges and marriage was huge. Mm-hmm. And when I say huge, because I think what you're going to see here, Tony, and what we've seen in the last few years, but it's going to get even more pronounced, is that there are going to be huge battles within the state legislatures and within ballot initiatives that will go forward where the people are rising up and saying enough. And that's exactly what happened in Iowa with the Supreme Court justices that were, in essence, thrown out because of their votes on traditional marriage.
Yeah, for those of the folks who are not familiar with what happened in Iowa there, why don't you give a little bit of the backstory there?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much very simple. I mean, the Iowa Supreme Court was, in essence, ruled same-sex marriage okay, if you will, and the voters had enough of it. And there's a long story about Iowa and in terms of their politics, how something like this can get on the ballot. It happens once every 20 years. It's a long story, but judges can, in essence, be thrown out of office. And that's exactly what they did. The voters in Iowa threw those three Supreme Court judges that voted for same-sex marriage out of office.
And I think it also resonates with something we talked about earlier, how you get the merging of the religious issue, in this case the moral issue, the same-sex marriage issue, with these more secular issues of the will of the voter, because one of the dynamics in those judge races was that there was a initiative passed by voters and then it was overturned by judges, and people say, hey, you know, we voted on this. Aren't you listening to us? You know, three judges or you seven judges that are out there, you have to respect the will of the people. So that's also separate than, you know, say, the moral issue specifically related to gay marriage, as I would take it.
Well, that's right. And that's what happened out in California, right, with Prop 8. I mean, it was the same situation out there. I mean, look, I think it goes to a larger issue, which is enough is enough. There are people, honestly, Tony, there are people that go to work every day, come home, you know, cook dinner, watch Wheel of Fortune, you know, at 7 o'clock Eastern or wherever time it airs out in Washington. But look, they don't want to be bothered. They really just want to go about their lives. But if you're going to, quote, tick them off enough, they're going to get off the couch and do something about it. We've seen that nationally with the Tea Party, and in Iowa we saw it with these judges. That, look, these judges, it was just enough. It was too much. And, you know, when it gets to be to the too much factor, people will get off the couch.
What's your thoughts? Recently, this came up as a controversy very similar to what went on in Iowa and California, where judges overturn a voter initiative. Down in Oklahoma right now, they had an initiative to prohibit judges from looking at international law when they're interpreting law here in the United States. And specifically, they, you know, in a religious sense, it was aimed at Sharia law. And that recently was overturned by a judge, but that initiative, a judge put a stay on it, says, no, we're not going to implement this thing until we take a bigger look at it. And again, it seems the will of the people moving in one direction, judges moving in the opposite direction. What's your take on what's going down there in Oklahoma?
Well, a couple things. I think what you're going to see in Oklahoma, or what you saw in Oklahoma, you're probably going to see in other places. It's going to crop up, this whole idea. You know, we talk about international law, but really, as it relates to the whole Islam situation, as it relates to Sharia law, I think you're going to see this probably pop up in many other areas across the country. Because why, Tony? The reason is because in this country, not to get on a soapbox or anything, as a journalist, I try to stay off my soapbox, but to provide some analysis, the Supreme Court in this country has, for decades now, many times sided on the view of, if you will, minority rights. I don't mean minority as an African American or Hispanic. I'm talking about minority as in the least percentage of people. And so, look, I think there's been, in essence, a catering to the minority rather than the majority opinion in this country. And I think, therefore, when you have the situation with the whole Sharia law and some of the Muslim populations in this country, I think you're going to see this challenge more, or at least advance more in certain communities. And what's going to end up happening is you're going to see this tied up in the courts quite a bit.
Do you think this is an issue of anti-Muslim bigotry, or, as you say, it's the majority finally getting upset with all the attention being paid to minorities at the expense of the majority?
I think it's a perception issue, Tony. I don't think it's necessarily anti-Muslim bigotry, but I think that there is a perception out there, for everything from 2001, September 11, 2001, and onward, that, you know, we're fighting a war against Islam, and, you know, it just happens to be the Muslim people are, you know, on, you know, kind of embroiled in all of that, and sometimes it's hard to decipher, you know, who's who. And part of the problem is that the moderate Muslim voices in this country that we hear so much about haven't really stepped to the forefront as much, and because they haven't, I think they've ceded the ground to a perception taking root.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the interesting things that, you know, harkened back to a survey that we were talking about before in terms of the New York City mosque was that a number of people tended to be wary of putting a mosque within a few blocks of Ground Zero. Yet that some of those same surveys asked questions, would you mind a mosque a few blocks away from you? And the answer most people gave was, no, that's no problem. It's just, you know, at that particular location, I have a bit of a problem with it. But in general, I'm not opposed to it. And to me, that it signaled that where a lot of the media attention was focused on anti-Islamic bigotry, it really wasn't as much bigotry as one would assume.
Well, that's right. It always had to do with the site. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the main problem. And just to tie that in a bow, just remember, when 2012 comes around, you can be sure that whoever the Republican nominee is going to be, this will come up. It will come up in one of the slickest advertisements you'll see, and it'll be a campaign issue in 2012. There's no doubt about it.
Mm, interesting. We'll have to wait to see what happens in 2012. In the remaining 10 minutes or so that we have here with you, one of the things I wanted to get at was your role as a Christian broadcaster in Washington, D.C. That in some ways that absolutely fascinates me. So we're a little bit off topic here, changed from the elections to, you know, what is it like to be working for CBN in Washington, D.C.? I mean, you're rubbing elbows with a number of the other White House correspondents there. So what's your reflection on that?
Wow. So we only have 10 minutes now. Well, first of all, overall, the experience has actually been a blessing and wonderful. There's been bumps and problems along the way, but I share a little of that with you. But first of all, it's a blessing absolutely work at CBN. Here in D.C., we're just a few-minute walk over to the White House, and before covering the White House, I was on Capitol Hill for 3 years. So it's been an absolute blessing. Having said that, you know, when you travel in the D.C. circles, there are two worldviews. There is the, if you call it the Judeo-Christian worldview, and then you have the secular worldview. And what you end up finding is that it's interesting because a lot of people say the media is liberal. Well, sure, they're liberal, but that's not really what drives them. I don't think the media is driven so much by their liberalism as they're driven by their worldview. In other words, they don't really understand. I shouldn't say they don't understand. They don't care to understand the other side, flyover country, if you will, the worldview of Christians in this country. They're more apt to take the Amtrak train from New York to Washington, D.C. and live in that Amtrak corridor and go to their social parties and all of that. You know, it's funny because I've been invited to a lot of these social parties, and quite frankly, I'd rather be with my daughter at Chuck E. Cheese in the suburbs, and that's what I do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I say that to say that there's a circle of these folks here in Washington that talk with each other, and it's an echo chamber. And that's pretty much all it is. And so I've had no desire as a Christian to get involved in the echo chamber. Having said that, I think it's important that as a Christian we go ahead and not to use the word infiltrate the mainstream media, but to have a voice in the mainstream media. Right. And, you know, God has blessed me quite a bit to be on Meet the Press 6 times during the 2008 midterm election, and obviously on CNN and other places now. And so, you know, I really feel a deep responsibility to be an evangelical voice out there. That doesn't mean that I'm going to cede my journalistic integrity / role, but what it does mean is that I can provide a worldview, a perspective on certain issues within that crop of reporters, within that crop of mainstream media professionals that they may not otherwise have thought of. And I think that's the value, because not only does it potentially reflect with them in terms of the stories they start to think about, but when I'm on the air, others across America can hopefully get a different perspective and hopefully a Christ-like one.
Yeah, you mentioned that earlier, how candidates or other individuals you talk to feel they have the opportunity to really open up on their religious side when you're there, as compared to Wolf Blitzer or somebody else,
right,
or one of the media. And so that seems to be, you know, a really huge benefit that you are providing that alternative voice there. But I mean, when you interview people, is there that feeling that people are relieved to be talking to somebody different who's asking very different questions? Or is it the case that, oh, here comes the Christian guy, okay, I got to put on the Christian cloak here? What are your thoughts on that?
Right. That's a great point. Well, let me just say that, you know, when the Christian guy comes calling, he's going to ask the Christian question.
Yeah.
Oh, heavens no, so to speak, no pun intended. But, hey, look, here's the deal. Sharon Angle is a good example. Okay, Sharon Angle is born-again Christian.
Mm-hmm.
She has a desire to talk about her faith. I'm going to ask her about her faith. Tim Scott, born-again Christian, wants to talk about his faith. I mean, the last time I checked, I can go to Google and go to Wikipedia, all right, maybe not Wikipedia, but, you know, some of those sites, and research these folks and realize that they that God is active and wants to, and is part of their life, and they want to talk about it. There's others, Carly Fiorina, who keeps that more to herself, and so while I'll ask that question, she may not reveal as much to me. So I think, quite frankly, Tony, that there is a relief for these candidates when they sit and talk to me, because they don't get asked that question about God and God's role in their lives, and they want to talk about it. They want to. Now, the problem for some of them has been that the media will take these quotes about God and turn it into a freak fest.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth of the matter is that ultimately they don't care, because they're giving God the glory, and that's all they care about. I'll never forget asking Sharon Angle a question. There were so many questions I asked her, but one I said to her, I said, you mentioned that there was a calling that she had. You know, she talked about this calling, and she had to get into the race, and then she says this to me, and I'll never forget this quote. I'm just reading it here real quick. She says, when God calls you, He also equips you, and He doesn't just say, well, today you're going to run against Harry Reid. There is a preparation. Everyone in the Bible, when you read the Bible, you can see that that preparatory time. Moses had his preparatory time. Paul had his preparatory time. Even Jesus had his preparatory time. And so my preparation began on a school board, and then talks about her resume, if you will. My point of reading that, Tony, is that the media took that and made it like Sharon Angle was comparing herself to Moses,
yeah,
and Jesus, and all that. Whereas, what was her true heart on it, Tony? Her true heart was that she was just saying a biblical truth, which is that God does prepare us for such a time as this. And whether it works out for a victory for Sharon Angle or not, that's not necessarily, as Paul Harvey would say, the end, the rest of the story. We're still waiting for the rest of the story with Sharon Angle and others.
Yeah, it must be an interesting challenge for you, too, when you're asking these questions, because they're questions that a lot of people in flyover country and possibly on the coast, you know, without them necessarily saying it outright, want to hear. They want to hear about a candidate's faith. It tells us a lot about the character of the candidate. Yet, you're walking this tightrope that when you ask some of these questions, you probably know that it will be picked up and soundbited by different medias in ways that it wasn't initially intended. How do you walk that tightrope?
Tony, that is such a great question and an astute observation, because it's a struggle for me to a degree, in the sense that I know that when I ask these questions, the media will pick up on it. You're right, and they will play it out of context. But ultimately, God is God, and ultimately, God is sovereign, and you know. I think when I start to try and question how his or her candidate's words are going to be used by the media, I think then we're trying to game it a little bit, and we're trying to figure it out in our own human humanness, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so I leave the details and how it's all going to work up to God. And I don't worry about that. I have a journalistic responsibility to not only ask tough questions about policy issues, which we do,
mm-hmm.
but I also have a responsibility as a Christian journalist to probe and ask about how God has influenced their lives. And you know what? If the media takes that out of context, so be it. But ultimately, you know, God's word will get out there. So, for example, I'm on CNN, you know, quite often, and they want to hear the Christine O'Donnells and the Sharon Angles and the Tim Scotts talk about this. And so I'll be on Wolf Blitzer's show, for example, and he'll run 3 minutes worth of Sharon Angle talking about God. And he won't run 8 seconds. He'll run 3 minutes on the Situation Room. And so what happens in that situation? Well, who knows who's going to be touched by those words? somewhere out in this country of ours, and they may want to, those words are powerful, coming from God, not Sharon Engel. And so I just leave it all to God and just let the chips fall where they may.
I think that's a great message to close on. It's that, you know, recognizing that God is in control of everything, and, you know, life plays out as it plays out, and we make our way through this life and praising for praising God for the greater glory that he's done. And I want to thank you very much for your perspective on the news, and I encourage our listeners to this podcast to check you out at The Brody File. We'll have links up on our website, as well as CBN and a number of news outlets that you're on. So, David, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion today.
Tony, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.